I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, and this is the Regional Roundup. Ahead this hour, it's a conversation with Patrick Harker, president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia. As we look forward to an eventual end to the pandemic, what lies ahead for the local and national economies? We'll also visit with local soul singer Mary Cross, a contralto whose voice and styling have drawn comparisons to the late Phyllis Linda Hyman. To begin, funeral services for the late John Chaney are underway at Temple University's Leocora Center this morning. A public viewing is being held until 1, followed by a private celebration of life service at 3. As a basketball coach, John Chaney made an indelible mark on Temple sports and Philadelphia, dedicating decades to the success on and off the court of the young men in his program. For many of us reporting on the news in Philly through the 80s, 90s, and early aughts, he was always a presence, even when he wasn't front and center, a unique piece of the crazy quilt fabric that is the Philadelphia sports scene. Chaney was passionate about his work, complicated, temperamental, and to those who knew him best, he was a kind man. In just a few moments, we're going to speak with the Philadelphia Inquirer's Mike Jensen, who covered Chaney for years. But first, we head out to the public viewing at the Leocora Center, where WHYY's Avi Wolfman-Arendt is standing by. Hello, Avi.
Hey, Mary. How you doing?
Well, thanks. So tell us about what you're seeing.
Yeah, so the public viewing began at 9 at the Leocora Center. There was a line well before then. And folks have been streaming through at a pretty regular pace. The court where Temple plays its games is where the public viewing is being held. And it's sort of a classic Chaney scene. People sort of quietly moving through, paying their respects, while Frank Sinatra plays in the background, including, of course, the song My Way, which for anyone who knows John Chaney just feels like the perfect sort of fitting song to summarize, you know, a lot of his life and his principles and the way that he treated basketball and the world beyond basketball.
So again, it's early in the service, Avi. There will be a celebration of life observation later today. Are there men who'd played for Chaney there right now? Are you recognizing any faces?
Yeah.
Who are you seeing?
Well, so the private service will begin later, but there's been folks who are connected with Chaney in various ways moving through, and I've had a chance to talk with some. And it's interesting because, you know, you do a story like this and sometimes people don't really want to talk. I have had people lining up because they just want to do an interview about John Chaney to tell their John Chaney story. I talked to a guy named Louis Fields who played at Chaney State University, which is where Chaney sort of got his college coaching career started. I talked with someone who knew him at Simon Gratz High School, was his gym teacher at Simon Gratz High School in North Philadelphia in the late 60s, early 70s, which is where he got his first high school coaching job. And so people are connected to him in so many different ways, and they just want to share. And I thought it was really summarized best by a gentleman who I talked with, and I asked him a very rudimentary question about his memories of Chaney, and he just looked at me and said, "If you're from North Philadelphia, John Chaney is it." Mm-hmm. And I thought that really summed it up.
All right. Avi, thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's WHYY's Avi Wolfman-Arendt, live from the Leocora Center. We now turn to the Philadelphia Inquirer's Mike Jensen. Hi, Mike. How are you?
Hey, Mary.
So hearing about the viewing at the Leocora Center right now, what are your thoughts?
Avi put it perfectly, that everyone has tales, and they're human tales, and that's what I've found over the last week. It's not a question of finding enough people. Mm. It's just sort of taking all of it in from hundreds of people and trying to figure out, you know, how to write about John Chaney. And honestly, that in itself is kind of a legacy to honor Chaney, because that's how it was covering him. That's how John was.
Well,
you know, you always had too much. Never, you know, so it was, which was a great problem for a reporter, obviously.
Well, you knew him really well. As a matter of fact, you had his home telephone number. Tell us about John Chaney. Who did you know? Who was the man you knew?
Yeah, I covered the last 9 seasons of John Chaney. What was around before, because I was covering college basketball, covered Villanova and Penn before that. So I was around John and around the issues of writing about, you know, initial eligibility issues, which was the core fight of John's life. So I was around, but covering John, I wrote a piece for the Inquirer about how I always said it was kind of like stealing money, because he just didn't use the word off the record. And because he had morning practices, you know, if you got there toward, you know, even caught the second half of a morning practice, you didn't have to be there at dawn for the start. He often wasn't there at dawn for the start. He'd stroll in after half an hour and get going. His assistants would run the first half hour. But then you'd go into his office, and he wouldn't kick you out. You know, if it had been an afternoon practice, he would have been running out of there, going to eat, saying, I don't have time for you. But it wasn't like that. So it actually worked to the advantage of us media types. And John, you know, you wouldn't try to call him. You wouldn't try to catch him until, you know, after 9 o'clock. And this was back in the days before there were cell phones. So you'd just wait, and Mrs. Cheney would say, nah, he's not home yet. Or John, and you'd catch him before he started watching NBA games at night.
Well, Mike, you wrote of his, quote, fierce devotion to offering a hand to lift those who most needed a lift. And just a moment or so ago, you referenced those NCAA eligibility standards. He was passionate about making a change when it seemed things were going in the wrong direction. Explain that some more, if you would.
Sure. Let's look at John's own life, first of all. He did not become a college basketball coach until he was over 40. He was, you know, working as a coach and as a teacher at Sayre Junior High or Middle School and Simon Gratz High School. Then he got the job at Cheney University. He was over 40 at that point. So this legend of John Cheney, he was over 50 years old when he got his first Division I coaching job at Temple, his only Division I coaching job. Obviously, he stayed at Temple. So, but going back further.
Mike, I think we might have dropped you, or the call, I should say.
To Bethune-Cookman and got educated there, and he got educated. No Big Five schools offered John Cheney a scholarship. So his beliefs came from his life, and his beliefs were that the NCAA policies weren't just racist. They were outside the realm of human experience, that by taking students who did not qualify with SAT scores and saying, not only can you not play, we won't even give you a scholarship to be at school. You'll have to pay your own way. It was just the wider world caught up and realized that this fight by Cheney and John Thompson, those two primarily, really, was rational.
This Mike would not have happened. The change in favor of these young men who might not otherwise have made the cut, so to speak, would not have happened without the efforts of John Cheney.
Yeah, there were conferences like the SEC and the ACC that just wouldn't take these students. So John Cheney, you know, took them, championed them, and gave him a hard time for 4 years, too.
Okay, let's talk about his influence on the women's game. I mean, you write today about two of the most successful black women's college basketball coaches in history, Vivian Stringer and Dawn Staley, and his relationship with them.
Yeah, I used the word mind-boggling a couple of times in it. You're talking about the two most successful black women's college basketball coaches in history, period. Vivian Stringer has taken three different schools to the Final Four. Dawn Staley is now the U.S. Olympic coach. She's won an NCAA title. She has the number one team in the country today. And they both started in gyms with John Cheney. And John Cheney, as I wrote, he didn't just kind of theoretically keep the door open. He was at the door demanding they come in and sit next to him. Vivian Stringer said she would work to finish his sentences. She would try that hard to emulate this man because she started at Cheney University when she was 23 years old as a coach herself. So John sort of gave, not sort of, gave her the blueprint. This is how you do it. And she has tried to follow it to this day. And Dawn Staley had never coached when she got to Temple. She was this great player, the best point guard ever in women's basketball. But she hadn't coached. So, you know, John was right there next to her, too, and has stayed in her life ever since.
And an immeasurable impact on so many people. In another article, you quote Dan Leibovitz, who's now associate commissioner of the Southeastern Conference. He worked for Chaney as an assistant coach. He says in basketball, Chaney's genius was really simplicity. How so?
Yeah, he liked the game simple. He liked just pound cake, he called it. Make the right pass. His guiding principle was no turnovers. That was John. You think about his defenses, but it was really that simple offense. And it didn't have to be pretty. That's not what it was about. It was about get a shot up. And if you get more shots up than the other guys, your chances of winning are pretty good. And I wrote about how, I mean, every day he would just talk about footwork and how to make those simple passes, what he wanted from them. And it had to be drudgery, but that's kind of what teaching is by repetition, right? Mm-hmm. And I said that you know, maybe it was just harping on five things, but those were the five things you had to play at the highest level. And when his guys went to the NBA, if they were good enough, they were ready for it.
We can't talk about John Chaney without referencing the fact that he was at times mercurial. Describe this part of his personality.
He was at times. Let's go often. I mean, he would go, and that was part of the fun of covering John Chaney. You did not know when he was going to pop off over what. I was up there when he went after John Calipari. I wasn't the Inquirer's beat writer yet, but I was filling in and I was up there. I mean, he was just, and
you know, Massachusetts John, coach, yeah.
Yes, and that was the most famous time he went off. But honestly, in day-to-day, he channeled, I mean, his rage would, sometimes it would be rage, sometimes it would often be funny. Sometimes things would be crazy, but his guys would be allowed to laugh even when he was giving them a hard time. So he wasn't a bully, but he was always he was a loud guy. Yeah.
And a good guy. And worth noting, Mike, that John Chaney and John Calipari were friends after they had their little and quote unquote falling out a number of years back. Well, Mike, it was so good. Thank you for you to join us here today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Mary.
Okay. Mike Jensen is sports writer for the Philadelphia Inquirer. And again, speaking about the late John Chaney, the Hall of Fame basketball coach for Temple University for so many years, a remembrance underway at the Leah Cora Center today at Temple University in Philadelphia. Up next, we speak with Patrick Harker, president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia. He'll give us his outlook on the local and national economy as the new year begins and or continues, I should say, amid the pandemic. Stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to the Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. COVID-19 has shaken national and local economies to the core. In response, Congress is grappling with another round of stimulus relief. Democrats are pushing ahead with President Biden's $1.9 trillion plan, the goal to have it in place by mid-March. And with vaccination underway, there is a light at the end of the tunnel. But it will likely take many months to achieve some semblance of normal. So what will the economic landscape look like once the pandemic eases? Which sectors will have been hardest hit? Will recovery move quickly or take years? And for those left jobless, a great many of them low-income earners, will opportunity come in time to salvage livelihood and home? Joining us now for analysis is the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia, Patrick Harker. Welcome.
Oh, good morning. Very happy Monday.
Well, good morning to you. Before we get the conversation underway, let's get the number out. It's 888-477-9499. Any listener who would like to join the conversation can also send an email to Radio Times at WHYY.org or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. So, Patrick Harker, the pandemic, of course, has been with us for about, 11 months now. Characterize, in your view, how it has reshaped Philadelphia's economy, the Philadelphia region's economy.
So there are some short-term and long-term effects it's had. Clearly, this has been an incredibly tragic period, starting with the virus. I mean, what's driving the economy is the virus. And I think we have to keep reminding ourselves of that. Until we get the virus under control, we can't get the economy back to where we want it to be or better than it was before. So that, first and foremost, we need to do what we need to do in terms of public health measures, vaccinations, et cetera, to get this virus behind us. Start with that. That said, the virus and this pandemic and the subsequent economic problems we've had are accelerating some of the trends we already saw. So some of the trends are new, like the pain that we see in hospitality and travel and tourism more broadly. But also, it's accelerated trends, say, in retailing. We were moving toward more online retailing anyway. This has just accelerated that trend. So one has to sort of disentangle the long-term trends that we were seeing, like retail, versus the short-term impact on travel and tourism and just entertainment broadly. That said, the Philadelphia region generally, through bad economic times, we never hit the lows of the rest of the country, nor do we ever hit the highs. We tend to be somewhat in the middle of the pack when it comes to economic growth.
Why is that?
Some of it is, I think, the maturity of our industries. That is, we don't have a lot of boom and bust industries. If you think about some other regions of the country, take, for example, I'll just use one example, that are highly dependent upon energy and extractive industries, they tend to vacillate much more than we do.
So let's go to, for a moment, President Biden's $1.9 trillion relief package. I know you said that we really can't move forward, if I'm hearing you correctly, until this virus is under control. But at the same time, Democrats in Congress are going to try to get this relief package pushed through. How might this help the economic recovery nationally? And what are the goals as you understand them?
So, again, at the Fed, we do monetary policy. We don't do fiscal policy. Mm. So I'm not going to talk specifically about the details within this plan, other than to say that we have put into our forecast for this coming year another $900 billion of relief to the American people. That's just a placeholder, right? A number we put in just to try to understand the macroeconomic implications of what's going on. That said, there is no question that there are certain groups, particularly low-income groups, minority groups, who need some help. We just put out some research recently on housing and housing forbearance. So people have been given a reprieve in paying, say, their mortgages or their rent, but that is going to come due, and the price tag's very high. And so how are we going to get through that? How are we going to not have people being evicted from a home during a pandemic in the middle of the winter? These are the kind of things I hope we can address to help smooth this process. That's the short-term issues. There's a lot of short-term help we need to get in the hands of the people who need it right now. Longer term, we can talk about this. Jobs are going to be changing. They were changing before due to automation. They're going to continue to change. We need to really accelerate our efforts, our collective efforts as a society, to get people upskilled into better paying, life-sustaining, family-sustaining jobs.
Do you see changes such as automation accelerating during the pandemic?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So why?
Typically, if you think about a typical company, right, they do a cost-benefit analysis. They look at the costs or benefits of technology, and there's always a fudge factor in there. You don't know the numbers exactly. So often you're a little risk averse, saying, the numbers don't quite add up. I'll hold off on making that investment. But because we saw even before the pandemic, the fact that companies were having a hard time finding workers. And then when the pandemic hit and workers couldn't come for a variety of reasons, including illness and social distancing, that pushed people over the edge to say, now it might be worth making that investment in technology. And that's exactly what's going on. It's accelerated again, yet another trend we were seeing before the pandemic hit.
And so with an acceleration in automation, does this perhaps hit adversely lower income wage earners?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, one of the areas, again, we'll go back to retail. So you think about what's happened. A lot of the brick and mortar retailers have really struggled, obviously, in this pandemic, particularly in the city of Philadelphia, because people just aren't there. The people who normally would come in every day for work aren't there. But we've gone to online. Well, online is a highly automated, if you've ever seen an Amazon facility, it's a highly automated facility. A lot of people, but a lot of technology. So some of the people that were once working in those brick and mortar retailers are not working now in those automated fulfillment centers.
There might be some encouraging news in a new report published by the Federal Reserve Banks of Philadelphia and Cleveland. As a matter of fact, there is some encouraging news there.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, which is essentially found, Patrick, that nearly half of all lower wage jobs in the larger labor markets can be paired with at least one higher paying occupation requiring similar skills. Tell us more about this in light of the changes that are also happening at the same time during the pandemic.
Yeah, thank you. I'm really excited about this work because I think it can make a big difference. So our researchers asked the following question. What are those jobs out in the economy, which we call opportunity occupations, that pay above median wages where you don't need a four-year college degree? And we've published this work. We've been publishing this work now for several years. They then went one step further and said, okay, in the 33 metro areas in the United States, if we look at those 33 metro areas across the country, how can we move people into better jobs, you know, family-sustaining jobs? They looked at these 33 metro areas, and what they found out is about, as you said, half the lower-wage jobs, you could upskill into a better job. And when they looked at all those possible transitions, the average increase in annual salary was $15,000.
That's considerable, yeah.
Yeah. And then they went even further, and we just launched this, and I'm really, again, excited about this. We launched a tool called the Occupational Mobility Explorer. This is a tool for people looking to transition into a better paying job, for companies thinking about how to help that process, or institutions like Philadelphia Works, local job boards, government job boards, thinking about their training needs, community colleges, et cetera. So let me give you two examples of, and this you can drill down on, and the Occupational Mobility Explorer will tell you what jobs you have now, the skills you have in those jobs, because people have skills. Everybody has some kind of skills. And the question was, how could you transition to a better paying job with some upskilling, but not going back for 4 years for a degree, but some upskilling?
So
they looked at these 33 metro areas, and in those metro areas, you can drill down and see what those jobs are, what the pay differential is if you upskill, and what the growth rate is of those jobs in the economy.
And again, we're talking about jobs that do not require a bachelor's degree.
That's correct, generally. No, they may require an associate's degree. But let me give you two examples.
Okay.
In the Philadelphia region, if you drill down into this Explorer, if you're a receptionist right now, you have skills. You could upskill to, say, be a medical secretary with an increase in salary of 27%. Or let's say you're a bill collector working for a financial institution. You're a bill collector. You could upskill into being a credit counselor with a similar set of skills with an average increase in salary of 45%. So there are opportunities there. And this is where we really need all of us to be pulling, you know, rowing in the same direction to help people make these transitions.
So when we're all pulling in the same direction, let's talk about employers. How can this tool be used by employers to benefit their hiring practices?
No, absolutely. Again, if you think about before the pandemic, and I know that's really hard for people to think about right now in the throes of what we're going through. But labor markets are incredibly tight, and employers started to think creatively about ways that they could partner, whether it's a public-private partnership with a government training program or with community colleges and other institutions and community-based organizations. We want to get back there. And so employers already know, the ones I've talked to who are thoughtful about this know they still need to do something to bring in the workforce that they need to be successful. Even though things are bad, they're not bad everywhere. For example, in manufacturing. Manufacturing in our region is doing okay. And what we're hearing from those manufacturers, they still need those skilled positions, right? They still need the machinists. They still need, they can't find these people. So while there are challenges, real challenges and pain in our economy, there are some glimmers of hope. And that's what we need to grab onto and really accelerate the changes that we're talking about.
We're speaking with Patrick Harker, president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia. So you mentioned manufacturing, Patrick. Where else are the jobs?
So, in high-tech manufacturing, but again, not just in those areas, there's lots of new opportunities. Use one example I use often from my old life when I was president of the University of Delaware. We stood up a set of cybersecurity initiatives and programs. Some of those we did with local community colleges in Delaware, Deltec, and with Hartford Community College down in Maryland outside the gates of Aberdeen. And Aberdeen is the U.S. Army's major cybersecurity center. These were programs, you could get a starting job in cybersecurity with an associate's degree. Often you think about that, oh, I'd need a PhD in computer science to do that work. No, you don't.
Okay.
There are lots of new jobs like cybersecurity. How many of these jobs existed 10, 15 years ago? So the economy is always creating new jobs. Our challenge, and I think our challenge collectively and individually, is to keep pace with that and find those new opportunities and find ways that we can get reskilled into those new jobs.
So Patrick, before we move on briefly, for our listeners, if anybody wants to access the Occupational Mobility Explorer tool, how do they do that?
Just go right to our website, the Philadelphia Fed website, and it's going to be right there.
Okay. The Federal Reserve met last week for I think it's the first time during the Biden administration. Interest rates will apparently remain at close to 0%. What does this mean for the average consumer?
So for now, the interest rate that we control is the Fed funds rate. It's the rate that banks lend to each other overnight. So it's the shortest of short-term rates. But that sets the floor on all the rest of the rates in the economy. So right now, mortgage rates will stay low and other rates will stay low for consumers. On the flip side, and there's basic rule of economics, there's no free lunch. So while that's good for consumers, for savers, it's not great. So there's a balancing act that we're trying to create. But in the middle of this crisis, these aren't normal times. So we need to try to do what we can do at the Fed to create the conditions so the economy can recover as quickly as possible with minimal scarring. So we've committed to keep rates low until we start to see real healing in the economy, both with respect to our dual mandate of employment and inflation. And we've committed to, for now, continue to implement our non-conventional, which is actually becoming more conventional, monetary policy tools of quantitative, what people call quantitative easing, but which really is buying assets, that, again, to help keep the rates low so that the economy can heal.
Okay. I'd like to get to a report from Oxfam International. Quote, the pandemic has hurt people living in poverty far harder than the rich and has had particularly severe impacts on women, black people, indigenous peoples, and historically marginalized and oppressed communities around the world. So, Oxfam is speaking on a global scale, but in your observation, is this the case at home
as well? Oh, absolutely true. Absolutely true. And again, if you go to our website, we've been publishing a series of reports on this. I mean, it is absolutely the case. Let's just take our backyard of Philadelphia, but this is true across the country. Mm. Those low-income workers that were in retail, hospitality, and so forth are disproportionately minority workers. And also women have gotten hit very hard in this crisis. So there is no question that this if you think about this in terms of a racial lens and racial equity, this really has exposed some real weaknesses we have in our economy with respect to the opportunities that people, particularly people of color, have. And that's something also we just simply have to address. And that's not only true for the jobs, but we also saw this with small businesses, you know, micro enterprises, 5-10 employee businesses or less, and their access to capital and things like the PPP program. That, and the problem there was, it wasn't that the banks weren't willing to lend, but these small businesses, say in Philadelphia, did not have existing banking relationships. They weren't going through a traditional bank. And so the bank didn't know them, and so they couldn't lend to them. These are the kind of things we're really focused on trying to solve, so that if and when, you know, God forbid, the next crisis of this magnitude hits us, we'll be better prepared.
Can't think about that for a long time.
No, we can't.
No. What are some concrete first steps, in your opinion, Patrick Harker?
So I think one of the things we can do, at least for small businesses, is really to work with the banking industry. And this is actually happening through the Greater Philadelphia Chamber of Commerce. There's a real focus on this issue of equity and racial equity, particularly for small businesses. Get them into the banking system. It's good to be in the banking system. The banks will have to provide competitive products that these firms can use, but we need to get more people into the system so that they aren't shut out for the kind of opportunities like the PPP loans that we're talking about. And again, for consumers, for people who need these jobs, this is the kind of work we do in community development at the Fed, and the Philly Fed's done, I think, phenomenal work in this area, the team, in helping firms, government agencies, community colleges think about how we can transition people into better jobs.
Okay, that's about it. We'll have to leave it there. Patrick Harker, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Patrick Harker is president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia. Up next on the Regional Roundup, we visit with South Jersey soul singer Mary Cross, whose work with renowned Philadelphia producers and musicians has garnered worldwide attention. Stay close.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You're listening to the Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Soul singer Mary Cross performs in South Jersey, Philadelphia, and across the country, and is now taking her career to the next level. Her debut single, In Love There's a Risk, produced by Grammy-nominated producer Donald Robinson, has received considerable play in the UK and Japan. Her sophomore release, The Promise, is out as well, and she's working on a full-fledged album. Cross is a contralto who some compare to the late Phyllis Hyman, and others have dubbed her the mother of cool smoke. Today we thought we'd listen to some of her work as we round out the show, and we'll speak with Cross about her music and her plans. So it is with pleasure we welcome Mary Cross to the Regional Roundup. Hi, Mary.
Hi, it's so good to be with you. Thank you for having me.
Well, of course. So I was thinking, why don't we begin by listening to some of your single, In Love, There's a Risk, again, which was written and produced by Donald Robinson, and then we'll talk about the song.
But at the same time, I'm hesitating, should we take this? Chance. Neither one of us wanna fall in love again. Contemplating if we can be more than friends. We both know. We both know. We both know. In love, there's a risk. In love, there's a risk.
That's just beautiful.
Thank you.
So, Mary, how did you end up on Donald Robinson's radar? He's a producer who's worked with the likes of Nancy Wilson and Vanessa Williams, Teddy Pendergrass. In fact, I understand that he wrote In Love, There's a Risk for
yes,
you.
Yes, he did. Well, actually, we were friends for a very long time, and I never actually requested he actually do any music for me, but I used to have a lot of shows locally, and when I'd have them throughout the tri-state area, a lot of my family, I call them family, not fans, they would ask me if I could do an album or some music that they could purchase of mine rather than my always doing cover songs. And I wasn't interested, but because they badgered me so much, I asked him if he would write something, and he came up with In Love, There's a Risk, and then it started receiving so much acclaim overseas in the UK. I wasn't prepared for how it transpired, so I didn't know what to do. I was like, oh, my God, I don't have an album out, and they were all asking me for more music. It was a great problem to have, but that's how it started.
So interestingly, you know, as you said, you know, the song did well in the United Kingdom, and you told John, our producer, John Ahrens, that soul music is really big in the UK. And in fact, your friends in the industry who sing soul music believe they'll never be as big here as they might be over there. Why do you think that is?
Exactly. From what I've heard, it's a lot of saturation here in the States. It tends to be that there are a lot of people who are putting out music. And also we have the regulations that radio is guided by when it comes to the material that is out now. A lot of the radio stations tend to play music that they are getting paid to play by the larger conglomerates. So in that instance, that would, you know, justify why we as indie artists don't have the money or the, you know, ability to ask them to play our stuff here in the States. So it makes it a little difficult for us. So with that said, the UK, because they have such a love for it, they've been playing the material in that way. The song has done really, really well and gotten a lot of attention over there, as well as in other countries like Japan, the Netherlands, all over the place. But it's just a little more challenging here, I think, because there are so many artists that have saturated the industry.
Do you plan to tour there once restrictions lift?
Absolutely. That's one of the first questions I get asked by them. They can't wait for me to come over, and I'm so honored. So honored. So I'm looking forward to it because I've never visited the UK before.
Well, describe the risk of loving someone as you see it.
Yeah, I think that because that covers so many different relationships, it can be relationships with family members as well as someone that you are very close to and consider your significant other. And I think that there are challenges that come with that a lot of times because people are so quick in this world that we live in to discard people as if they don't really matter or it's not really a relationship they want to get into. Or even if they've been with someone a long time, like commitment-wise, they would say, I don't know if I necessarily want to stay with this person my whole life or I'll do whatever I have to do for this time and then I might discard it. Like, it's not important to me anymore. And I find that, you know, you do take a chance when you get into a relationship with anyone. You don't know how things are going to turn out. We're always hoping for the best, and those of us who are hopeless romantics. But we all know that after the love has lost its shine, you really have to really want to be there because that's what you've committed to do and you really care about that person beyond whatever that quote-unquote in love portion is. It's beyond that. So it is a risk that you take, and you hope that someone will take care of your heart and take care of the relationship that you have with them in whatever capacity.
Yeah, well, you've been married, I think it's 25 years. And I'm in a long marriage as well. You know, it is easy to get comfortable. How do you keep things going, Mary, especially in a time like the pandemic, which has just stressed so many relationships?
Oh, my goodness. Well, one, you have to have great communication, and they have to be your best friend. You have to be committed to, you know, believing in whatever their dream is or whatever they want to do, whatever that covers or encompasses. And I find that if you can have someone that you can spend time with, that you get to know and you can talk to them about anything, and you can make it through a lot of these tough times. I think that that's one of the problems. Relationships, everybody has a different love language, so they tend to communicate differently. And sometimes people shut down. And being in a house with someone, it's almost like cabin fever. During this pandemic time, it's like you're able to travel or go out and do other things. So you're kind of stuck. And I think that rather than feeling in a negative sense that you're stuck with someone, it would be nice to feel but you just love them and they respect you and you have a good enough relationship that they support what you're doing. And in my case, he's very supportive. My husband, Jeff, is very supportive of my musical career. And that has been such a big help because there's no way you can do this without the support of someone who's going to be with you.
Oh, yeah. Well, listen, your sophomore single called mm-hmm. The Promise. In this song, mm-hmm. you celebrate relationships and marriages that have stood the test of time. So we're going to play a little bit of that right now.
Awesome.
Father, help us to be whatever it is we need. Let the sea or this journey of
Mary, how did singing begin for you?
Well, I started out in the church. Funny story is that my friends and I used to play outside, and I used to mimic the Captain and Tennille song, Love Will Keep Us Together. And I thought I was mimicking, but they were like, no, I think you can sing. So one of my neighbors, she was so kind. She was in church, and she said, why don't you come to church with me? And then I joined the choir, and that's how it all started. I started singing solos and singing duets with some of the other choir members, and I had been singing in church this whole time. And then the last 3 years is when I started a band and decided, because of my love for all other types of music, that I was going to start the band and just sing some of that stuff. So it could be songs by the Beatles and Sarah Bareilles and Norah Jones. I do soul artists. I do all artists. I love all types of music. So I kind of combine everything into a show that I perform for.
How do you move between styles? Because I know you also sing jazz and rhythm and blues too.
Yes. Well, it's pretty easy because I like to make it my own. So it wouldn't necessarily, my style is definitely the brand that I have. And I think that because of that, I have a different sound. And because of that, I don't compromise that. So I give the audience, it's more of an experience for me because we're connecting. So all of my songs tend to have a different sound, and they still embrace whatever the song is that I'm doing as far as the covers and things of by blues artists or whomever. But it also has that originality that lets you know that it's something that I spent time with when I have the band work on a project. We do it in such a way that it still allows them to hear me and also hear the original integrity of the song, but still have some kind of an original thing to it.
So what can we expect to hear on your forthcoming album? How are there going to be touches of soul, of jazz, and even gospel?
Yeah, well, actually, the Promise song crossed over into jazz, which was really interesting with it being pegged as soul, because Carl Cox, the celebrity saxophonist who's played for Mesa with Incognito, and he's played with Gerald Veasley and so many others, he actually was featured on Promise. And as far as the other music, I'm sorry, that will be on the album. It will definitely consist of blues. I will do gospel. I will have a gospel song on there. And definitely it's going to consist of other music as well that has to do with soul. I love soul as my basis because classic soul music is what people tend to be starved for. They miss that soul music, a lot of what Gladys Knight used to do and other artists. So I want to still stick with that because that's the integrity of what I started doing and what tended to get a lot of people interested in my music. And I don't want to lose sight of that, but I do love and will definitely embrace a lot of other tunes. There's one song that I absolutely love called I'm Glad There Is You. And it's just, I love Nina Simone's songs. I love songs by a lot of people, so it makes it very challenging to choose one. But there are certain ones that I'll be doing for a Valentine's show I'm doing on Sunday. And I hope folks can tune in because it's going to be great. It's going to be an online performance. And it'll have a little bit of everything in it.
So you also call yourself a stylista, and your bio says, when you were introduced to the music of Phyllis Hyman and Nancy Wilson, it wasn't just their beautiful voices you found appealing, it was the elegant attire they wore on stage. Yes. How can fashion make the singer, in your opinion?
Oh, my goodness. I think it makes a statement. First off, the thought is that these people who have come to see you that evening, they have traveled and passed a lot of other places or venues that they could have chosen to go to, but they chose to spend their time or their evening with you, and they can't get that time back. So for me, it means a lot to give them a great performance, and that includes being on stage and changing my attire for the evening. I believe that the grace and elegance of women who performed on stage in that way is something that could be missing nowadays. I've gone and attended performances where folks wear, you know, other things like jeans or other stuff that isn't necessarily what I would wear. But I definitely love the idea of giving people my very best. And I mean, from the things that you wear on stage to the music that you put together as a compilation for that evening. I think it's important that people see that. And for me, the glam of the ages of wearing a hat and wearing a gown and coming on stage in such a way that they're not used to seeing or that's missing in the times that we're living in, I like to do that because I love clothes, of course, but also I tend to think people appreciate that. When you go the extra mile, you're not just throwing stuff on. You think about what you're going to do and what you're going to wear.
What does shopping look like for you? Do you have any favorite designers?
Oh, my goodness. I love Norma Kamali. I love a lot of different people. And some are artists or actually designers that no one would know about. Jay Pratt is one of my favorites as the local designer here in New Jersey in Runnymede. And it just varies. I buy a lot of clothing from Nordstrom and Macy's, a lot of gowns. I love Calvin Klein gowns. And I love, I forgot the name of the designer. Slips my mind. Oh, MacDougall. I wear a lot of their gowns because I absolutely love them, the way they're made. The one I wore in the video that I did for Promise was one of them, MacDougall's gowns.
So just away from music for just a second, I've read, Mary Cross, that you've worked in management for many years at the Rowan School of Medicine and that you volunteer at a vaccination clinic.
Yes, Rowan Medicine has a vaccination clinic here, and I do indeed volunteer there a few days a week, usually an afternoon, like I'll be over there this afternoon, and sometimes I'll do a full day, depending upon what the need is. But yeah, I find it to be very rewarding. The people who come in are wonderful, and they're so kind and so grateful, you know, and I'm so glad that we are able to provide this service to them. And I believe we were the first vaccination center here in South Jersey that started vaccinating folks in the region. So I'm very proud of that. And I've been with the university for 20 years now. So it's when it used to be University of Medicine and Dentistry of New Jersey. And
two completely different worlds, the stage and
indeed.
Yeah, you're making it work. So I understand you live not far from Voorhees, Magnolia, and Cherry Hill.
Right.
And again, you perform in South Jersey. You've called it the best kept secret. Why is that?
I think because a lot of times people always think that we have to be living in Pennsylvania or Delaware or some other region. But there is so much great talent here. And I'm a native of Camden, New Jersey. And Camden, New Jersey happens to have a lot of royalty that came out of it that had to do with soul music, from Carla Benson, who is the most recognized recorded a person that's recorded music for so many other parties, Leon Huff came out of Camden, New Jersey. So it's various people that have come out. And I don't think people know that because a lot of times folks embrace them and always say, oh, they're from Philadelphia or they're out of the Pennsylvania region. So there is a lot of great royal talent that has to do with Camden and the region there around it in South Jersey. And a lot of times I think it gets overshadowed or people just put us into the box to say they're from Pennsylvania region. So
hey, Mary, thank you.
We got a lot of great stuff.
I got to stop you there. We're out of time, but thank you so much for joining us. Best of
my absolute pleasure. Thank you so much. Have a great day, Mary.
You too.
And thank you to your listeners.
That's, of course. By the way, our engineer today has been Diana Martinez, producer John Ahrens, with help this week from Debbie Builder. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. As always, thanks for joining us. Stay safe and be well. We're going to close the show with Mary Cross's You Can Change It.
But here's the chance you've been waiting.